named Uranus.
Now, Uranus was actually the father of a triad. He was therefore the first part of the cosmic mind triad. He was the first aspect released by Phades, the symbol of universal intellection. Uranus, or Uranus, therefore, was the god of the sky. Well, actually, he was the deity within whom all other things lived and moved and had their being. For creation must take place within him, as he must function within the next larger area. These monads are always retiring to the center. So Uranus becomes the symbol of a great power. And this tremendous principle of heaven itself has various terms or titles bestowed upon it. It is the omnipotent, inasmuch as nothing that is beneath it can resist it. It is not immortal. They are the knowers. Intelligibles are things that may be by substance known, or may by substance know. In other words, an intelligible deity is one that can be known without the necessity for intellection, or may know without intelligence, as we know the term. Therefore, the intelligibles are those who are known by apperception, or are known by the instinctive consciousness of man himself. Beings that you do not define by thought, but you learn of by experience, by inwardly perceiving the fact, not by ordinary reason or rationalization, but more by mystical experience, by flash of divine insight, as the prophets of old or the sages who talked with the great ones, according to the scriptural writings of most people. These are the beings that are known as a direct impact of consciousness, not an impact of intellect alone. So Uranus, Uranus, the great symbol of heaven, was therefore the master of the great court in which the stars were innumerable courtiers and gods over which he presided. And in this great world which he was master over, there was one thing, however, which he could not master, because he was not immortal. And the thing that everything is a slave to who is not immortal is time. Time, regardless of vastness of duration, destroys ultimately anything that is destructible within time. So Uranus, according to the Greeks, the sky in infinite motion, by the fact that it possessed infinite motivation and mutation within itself, whether it knew it or not, inevitably became a clock. These time mysteries rose out of the very motions of the heavenly bodies themselves. And all of motion immediately creates time interval. Therefore, Uranus was the father of Cronus, who was the symbol of time. Now, Cronus is spelled in two ways, either with a K or with a C. And Cronus spelled with a K is not merely the Greek form of the Latin. The Greeks themselves recognized two forms of the deity, although we use the two forms of spelling as the simplest way of differentiating them. This would not be quite in the Greek way, but it helps us not to confuse the two names. The Greeks recognized a Cronus that represented a principle of time. and then a chronos that simply represented the movement of time itself. One was the law behind time, and the other was time in its own natural motions. The law behind time is wise and deep and mysterious, but time itself is a despot, the reaper. And those who do not understand the law will hate the manifestation. But those that understand the law will know why the operation of it is the greater good. But man must know the principle or the power behind things in order to become aware of their goodness or their necessity or their nobility. So Cronus becomes now the second aspect of a triad. And of course, remember that each of these triads branches off and has secondary triads dependent upon it, but we cannot pause for those at the moment. We come, therefore, Vrabhuranus, which is the father of this great intelligible triad. We pass to the second power of it, which is Cronus, the power, for time is the power which rules creation. And then we come to the third aspect, the mind of the triad. And this is Zeus. And we have a triad again established now, representing the primary trinity of powers. The father, the power of the mind, Uranus, Saturn or Cronus, and Zeus or Jupiter. These three together constitute what might be termed the middle world. And they are divided by the hypothetical time factor. The superior part of this triad pertains to the great cycle of heaven, which is Uranus. The inferior part to Zeus, which is the beginning of the mundane diffusion of things. The second part is Cronus in its own right. Now these three deities together, moving into the human analogy, for all these things apply on innumerable levels, so carefully worked out that it is almost inconceivable. But on the human level, these three represent the psychic field of man. We therefore have man located between three tremendously contending parts of his own nature. We have the psychological emergency created in man by time, the resistance of ambition to time. We find the human soul having its actual terrible journey through time, the seeking to escape time, and the tyranny of mind in the more material sense that we know it in. So we have these three great dynasts that take over the universe. We have Phanes, the splendid symbol of cosmic intellect, universal divine mind, creating a world in which this divine mind is divided into three parts. And these three parts may well be represented by the superconscious mind as Uranus. The conscious mind, as in this case, Zeus, and the subconscious mind by Cronus, the peculiar binding factor which holds these things together. But we must realize that in the development of the human mind, the conscious mind was the last to appear, not in the middle, as might be implied from our placing the term consciousness between unconscious and superconscious. These terms are more or less obsolete in psychology, but they will help us to orient this concept in Greek mythology or Greek religious philosophy. So we have that part of mind which contemplates the nature of reality within itself. And we have Uranus who, so to say, dreams the creation of the world. The mind which of itself never actually changes, but permeates through into the conditions set up within itself. We have this mind suddenly bound by the limitation of time. We find that which is neither old nor new, suddenly becoming old and new. We find time taking up the tyranny over the universe, as represented by Saturn or Cronus. And then we find, in turn, the kingdom taken from Cronus, as Cronus took it from his father, and the kingdom turned over to Zeus. And why was the kingdom in this case turned over to Zeus? Simply because in the procedures of these things, they must come out of time, the primary production of mind moving with time, and that is law and order. Consequently, out of the various subjectives and the various mysteries of things arises the demiurgic power, the orderer, the organizer, that which comes forth to make all things possible, to make all things reasonable. Therefore, we have Zeus emerge as human consciousness emerges in the process of maturity. In the Greek philosophy, man as a spiritual being has always a certain divine consciousness natural to him, which would correspond to Uranus. He descends into the mystery of generation, as Narcissus, looking at his image in the pool, falls in and drowns. He then has another kind of mind, the mind of death, the mind of the reaper, or the mind of disillusionment and despair, Saturn or Cronus. And having therefore attained a new position, having ascended to a middle distance between heaven and earth, he then becomes a human mind. And by taking his human mind, he disposes of the phantoms of the superior and the inferior, and locks himself into the true concern of his own kind, which is the appearance of the universe of Zeus. Zeus is called the Demiurgus because he is the secondary leader of the world. He is secondary in the sense that he represents an intellect, that he represents the entire world embodied in a being. And at the moment he appears as such, he immediately has to become a triad also, because he has to be a father, a power, and a mind in himself. And in creating the father, power, and mind triad out of Zeus, the ancients came with the three divisions of the lower world: Zeus, Zeus Poseidon, and Zeus Hades. These were the three forms of Jupiter. Zeus was the airy power of the mind. Poseidon, the watery power of the mind. And Hades, the earthy power of the mind. Therefore, Hades also became the symbol of the underworld. And in our understanding of the Greek myths, we realize that Zeus Hades, the lord of the underworld, is actually the ruler of the sublunar sphere of mankind. This world in which we live, not the world into which we may depart at death, but this world in which we live is under the rulership of Zeus Hades. This is his world. This is the world of the dead. Beyond it and around it is a great psychic sphere ruled by Poseidon, which is the abode of heroes. For you will remember that Odysseus was a hero of the order of Poseidon. And for offending the Lord of the Seas, he was sent upon the perilous and terrible journey in which it seemed that the oceans were bent upon his destruction. But Poseidon was the psychic field of the earth, and Zeus was the intellectual or airy atmosphere of the earth. So that the mental world of man is under Zeus, the emotional world of man is under Poseidon. And the physical body of man and his physical empire is, as the Greeks call, the three parts of a blessed God. For this God is Zeus. Now, how are we to understand the parallel or comparison between this concept of Zeus, in which Zeus is no longer a person at all, with the bearded Olympian Zeus of Phidias, that is probably one, or was one, of the world's most magnificent artistic achievements? The artist was asked that himself many hundreds of years ago, and he replied very simply that it was his purpose to portray something of the magnificence of this mundane mind in which all things that take place do take place. That it was to remind the beholder that this material universe in which we physically exist is not a terrible place and not a horrible abode of punishment, but is the body of a blessed God. And that it is what we make it to be, but that over it rules an intellect which man may come to feel or to know in some respect by looking up at the great ivory face of the Olympian Zeus, the majesty of it. This is the true majesty of the world, not the majesty of selfish human beings, but the majesty of the plan. This is the face that the physicist looks into when he explores space, or the astronomer. This is the very presence into which we would hurl a satellite. It is this great body whose body nature is, and God the soul. So this Olympian Zeus is our mundane creation. And it is the child born out of the mystery of time, as Einstein so well pointed out, measured by the time of Cronus and the continuum of Uranus. And these are mathematical elements, just as certain as in any equation that can be produced in physics. The thing is, we have thought of them so long as legends that we have forgotten all about the fact that these are the mysterious little characters of a secret alphabet, by means of which the most intricate experiments of mankind can be quickly organized and then presented in the form of a charming fable, meaningless to those who are not initiated, but meaningful to those who are. So we have come into this problem of the dynasts. The why, we will say, in the terms of Greek philosophy, was any part of this necessary? And the Greeks tell us that there is a deity that exists in the very substance of things. And this deity is Themis, the law. And Plato speaks of the universe moving upon the spindle of Themis. That also there is a mysterious power which is called necessity. That necessity is the strange driver or master of many things in nature. In the very ancient beginning of all of this, when the principle of principles rested sublime and supreme within itself, it possessed within its own nature, archetypally, the three powers that had to come forth from it. It did not cause these powers, according to Greek thinking, to come forth by any conscious or volitional action of the will. The principle of principles, because it contains all things, contains the principles of these powers innate within itself, for nothing can come from it that is not in it. And the urgency of principles includes the urgency of the inevitable manifestation of that which has the potential of being manifested. So in the Greek system, the manifestation of things is not according to a will, but is according to the innate and intrinsic quality of the thing itself. The acorn does not grow into a tree because it is ordered to do so, nor does it plan beforehand what kind of a tree it is going to be. It possesses the principle of growth, and it is simply true to that principle. And by fulfilling its own inevitable purpose, it becomes in due time a magnificent tree if all the circumstances are propitious. Therefore, creation is a tree with its root in the principle of principles. And this tree grows not by the will of any person, but by the inevitable power of its own principles, that periodically, consistently, according to the great rhythms of existence, the periods of fertility and sterility follow each other in the universe. And periodically, being produces. The principle becomes germinal or fecund in its own nature and causes the emergence of the inevitable qualities. This is not an act of a particular kind, because in a being in which all action is omnipresent at all time, action is as much an inevitable as the transcendency of action. Thus, it is eternal rhythm, eternally manifesting itself, that causes these things to occur. And the first to emerge, ether or eros, love, immediately sets all other necessary things in action. For the procedure is gradually downward, until finally the intellect is established. The intellect is not potency in the nature of deity, but potential in the nature of deity. And deity becomes intellectual only through intellectual creations of its own. Therefore, a deity, the principle of principles, which may not know itself, is known by its own progeny, because it is the privilege of the progeny to release these powers. And in the releasing of these powers, there is this eternal growth forever taking place throughout the universe. The releasing of these powers also means the systematic exhibition of the principal powers that are in the nature of the principle of principles. And as this must be a father of power and of mind, we say that the principle of principles in its own nature is the father. In the form of eros, or in the form of ether, it is power, and in the form of chaos, it is mind. For mind begins with the chaos of ignorance and must conquer it. And the rising up of the Demiurgus, or Zeus, is the final victory of the mind principle over the Titans, which are the remnants of the primordial giants, or the uncontrolled and uncontrollable forces of nature. And in the Greek thinking, it is the tyrant that creates the mind. It is the peril of the being which forces the emergence of its own consciousness. Now the Greeks, for one reason which we are not too sure of, apparently did not use the term consciousness. They have no equivalent for it in Greek. So that what we would term this conscious part of man, they cover under one form of intellection or another, having a series of different types. Their term intelligible, as contrasted to intellectual, would come very close to our concept of consciousness. Consciousness, again, however, with them, always implies consciousness which knowing creatures bestow upon unknown objects or conditions. Therefore, we look up into the ethereal diffusion. We cannot see Zeus seated upon his Olympian throne anywhere in space around us, any more than we can find the concept of our God in space as he appears on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome. We cannot find this old man throwing out the sun in front and the moon behind. He is something we cannot explain in terms of fact. But in the Greek thinking, we explore with our own mind the cause of phenomena. And when we gradually isolate this thing which lies at the root of what we are and what we do, we come up, as Sir James Jeeves came up, with the concept of a world mind. We say there has to be an intelligent power at the root of things. And because we have observed this need, we then create Zeus, just as Phineas created him. We create him because he is necessary. Therefore, we say with the Greek that there is a peculiar deity called necessity, and that this peculiar deity is a gadfly that is forever goading on to all achievement and all things that man does. We come to the conclusion, as Jeeves came, that the hypothesis of an intellectual agent at the root of life is necessary. There is that very term coming in. We cannot explain other things without this hypothesis. And to the Greek, we cannot explain the universe without the hypothesis of Zeus. Having therefore come to this hypothesis, we must then explore it. And in the common parlance of the arts, it would be very difficult for us to imagine a moral force which we could not enrich with a personality, dramatize, and associate with the various values of life. So the Zeus we know, like the Olympian Zeus, is carved by our own genius, invested with our own attributes, not because we have invented it, but because we have discovered it to be necessary. That is the peculiar point of their philosophy, that the exploration of space is the continuous discovery of that which is necessary. Now, until we discover it, we do not know that it is there. After we have discovered it, we do not know what it looks like. It is a postulation. Perhaps it is something that is so intangible that we have in the instinctive intent to place it in a remote place to signify its own qualitative remoteness. But we must assume it. We are continually discovering these attributes. We are continually finding our dependency upon monadal units. So we surround our present life with a monad. And we finally call this monad Zeus. And we must struggle with it until we master it, until we discover its nature. Now Zeus, representing the monad, is the lowest aspect of soul and the highest aspect of mind. This is a very interesting mathematical formula also. Man seeking to discover the universe is seeking to master its aspects. He does this by the mysterious and terrible threefold journey of the mysteries. As Orpheus, he must descend into the underworld, which is Hades. And here he has his material existence. And here he would like to save his soul, but he cannot escape the temptation to look back and to fall back again into his own ways, old ways, so that the soul slips away and is lost to him, as in the legend of Eridiki. Then, like the water hero, he attempts the great journey, the Odyssey. Here he explores the mysteries of the ethereal diffusion of the human life of things. He discovers that souls falling into generation come under the control of Poseidon. He realizes also that the human sphere finally fell into the earthy, or was absorbed into it, which was one of the reasons for the mysterious story of the disappearance of the empire of Poseidonis, or Atlantis. And he discovers that the power of this sphere lies in its emotional content, so that he finds a psychic life, an emotional life, in the humid or liquid psychic field. Then he ascends still further, now to discover Zeus himself in his proper nature as pure mind. Pure mind arising in the substance and essence of pure reason. But as reason is greater than mind, so the father of Zeus, Cronus, which is reason, mind plus perfect time. This pattern gives us the next order of deities. So the ancients, the Greeks, regarded Zeus as the peculiar father god. He is mind. Therefore, being mind, it is not purposeful or meaningful that he shall be any better than he should be. The idea that mind was going to wander around in a saintly state of merely inspiring people to do beautiful and wonderful things was too ridiculous for the Greeks to be interested in it. This mind was the mind that they knew. This is mind. The mind that came through to them with all of its vicissitudes and its inconsistencies. And they were perfectly aware of the fact that this mind was a tyrant and was a despot, that this mind was forever ravaging the earth, seducing man into the thoughts and ideas that were unsuitable to his survival, that this mind was a tyrant, always involving divine and human matters, and all the legends of Zeus and his involvements in human affairs are perfectly proper when you realize the Greek says this: the only mind that I know is the mind that I am. If I place any blessedness upon this mind, I am projecting it. But if I move with this mind, I shall discover it. And in the Greek point, therefore, necessity constantly pressed on to the discovery. When man is perfect, he will then come into a concept of a perfect mind. Until then, he cannot. So Zeus is the mind as it is, the mind that plagues us all, the mind that manifests through to us as our politicians, as our warmongers, as our strikesters, shall we call them, at the present time in the food markets. All these things represent the story, the struggle, the conflict, the ups and downs, the good, the bad, the humor, the tragedy. And yet all of this suspended from one point, the despotism of the intellect. Each individual in every one of these situations is right. And because he is right, he is Zeus, sitting on his little throne and doing things that other people do not approve of, but getting away with them because he has the power to do so. Yet this Zeus is not all bad. He is, in many ways, a very commendable character, because like mind, he makes possible many good things, and he makes possible, among other things, the protection and preservation of Dionysos Zagros, the Savior God. Because it is this mind that out of its own struggles and its own miseries and its own misfortunes also has the strange knack of raising up the heroes, the men who are forgotten, persecuted, martyred in their own day, live on to be remembered. Each human mind is wrong, but the mass of human mind is a little wiser than any part of itself, and we see this constantly. Temporarily, we reward the wrong person, but in the long run, the false and the true are strangely sifted out. So this mind also, like Zeus, has a ponderous power of justice in the root of itself. And it's this justice that causes Zeus to call in the help of Thetis or Themis, the law, in all these different problems that arise, just as Votan called upon Erder, the great earth mother, for wisdom and leadership in the emergencies of his living. Zeus, then, is not any more peculiar than the principle as we know it for which he stands. Yet he is divine and he is royal, because he is born to us from a superior power. He has been preserved to us by a strategy, for his mother substituted a stone in order that he should not be devoured by his own father. Cronus, in order to prevent the universe from falling into the power of man's mind, devoured all his own children. He did this in the same way that time, it is said, eats up everything that is generated by it. Time devours all of its own progeny. But here we have another phase of a very well-known story about a couple in the Garden of Eden. And this couple was warned that there was certain fruit they should not eat. But they ate that fruit anyway. And the great power said that they must not eat this fruit, because they would then become as gods, knowing good and evil. Now you would have thought the gods would have wanted them to. Nice, happy, good gods should have wanted that. But instead of that, Adam and Eve were punished. And later, when Prometheus brought the flame in a hollow reed from heaven and gave it to man, giving him the power of internal light, Prometheus himself was punished by being crucified upon a rock of Mount Caucasus, and the vulture placed forever gnawing upon his liver, from which he was ultimately to be saved only by the intercession of Hercules. But in any event, the point of the matter is that mind taking over or usurping the kingdom of Cronus was a very strategic and important thing in Greek thinking. It was mind taking over and conquering the mystery of time. Now, mind taking over or escaping time meant a great deal if we begin to understand it, because man is a time-born, time-bound creature. His little life is rounded with a sleep, and that sleep is measured by time. 70 years, 40, maybe 50, if very fortunate or unfortunate. But usually, time is of the essence of things. In this time tyranny, therefore, mind finds itself allotted a span in which it must achieve. And man as an individual has to grow up, mature, enrich his intellect, and become his own Zeus by the conquest of his inferior nature within a time allotment. And against this background of time, the struggle of the mind goes on forever. Yet this same struggle is important to Zeus also, because Zeus forever sought to find the secret of his own time. He tried, like Wotan, to find out the riddle of his own destiny, and he found out all else. But his own destiny he could not solve. And the same problem affects us in every concept that we have today. So mind, which has been called in India the slayer of the real, but is nevertheless absolutely necessary to the discovery of something. Mind leads us finally to the discovery of world mind, and the further discovery that world mind is suspended within the structure of world soul, and that as the human being evolves from hierarchy to hierarchy, the great pageantry of the Greek mythology opens up as a tremendous philosophical document, a document suited to inform him on almost any subject with which he happens to be concerned. Now, if we go now to these three worlds and consider them for a moment, these three together, the world of spirit, the world of mind, soul together, and the world of body, constitute the three great spheres over which diagrammatically and substantially Uranus, Cronus, and Zeus have balanced government. And there we have the triad, the creator, the preserver, the destroyer. We have the great tributa of the Hindus and the symbol of the number three. Pythagoras said the triangle, or the first three numbers, are not really numbers but numerals, because they are all symbols of ideas. And the symbols of the three basic ideas reflect themselves as spirit, soul, and body, represent themselves as the three worlds, heaven, earth, and hell, are found, of course, in the triple crown of the supreme pontiff of the Roman Church and the triple tiara of the Dalai Lama of Lhasa. Always the temple of heaven in China with its three arches, its three domes, the symbol always of the triform universe, a universe in which there is a motion from pure spirit through a psychic mental nature to a physical or material or energy condition. Now, energy in this substance, or in this subject, relates to Poseidon, who represents the sidereal energy of nature. Each of these deities have their own energy fields. These fields are compatible one with another, so that once you learn the master scheme, you can identify it on each and every level. We are told that in this great order of the dynasts, every power stole its throne from its predecessor. In so doing, we come to another important thing, namely that it is in the involutionary or descending arc of human growth and development that each form of life attains its own individuality by blocking out the memory or knowledge of that which has gone before. If, for example, into this mortal sphere as we know it now, into the world of Zeus Hades, man could bring the memory of his previous state, he could not be captured here. If his memory could go anywhere else, he could not be held here. Nothing that happened here would mean anything to him if he knew more than he knows here. That problem has been brought up in connection with Christian theology for a great many centuries. Namely, could Christ suffer if he was God? Could he suffer on the cross? Could God be crucified in more than an appearance? That is an unsolved mystery. But the point of importance to our thinking is that if inwardly we positively and factually knew more than is necessary to live here, we could not be bound here. Nothing here would make any difference unless it was important while it was happening. And it can only be important because it is bigger than our ability to cope with it, or that it fulfills something that at the moment we regard as important, or that it damages something which at the moment we regard as important. Therefore, our ability to function here depends upon the fact that we do not know enough to escape. Therefore, the gates or doors of the mysteries were kept open in the Greek system in order that human souls could escape from the tyrannies of these various gods and could return again up the ladder of the divinities to the primary cause, as Plotinus explains this to us. But always we must go through the God to reach that which is beyond him. We find this same thought carried in the Christian faith, where the Master is caused to say, "None cometh unto the Father save by me." In other words, you cannot go around the power and evade it. Therefore, in the Greek mythology, the figure of Zeus represented a state of mental individuality that had to be achieved by the individual. He could go no further. He could not say, "I don't like Zeus, I'm going to have nothing to do with him." You can't escape, because Zeus represents the collective monad in which the whole mathematical pattern of your present condition exists. You cannot move until you outgrow the pattern. You cannot escape until consciousness permits you to flow into the next larger monadic unit. To get out, therefore, you must have solved the mystery of the labyrinth. You must have found the Minotaur. And you must have the thread of Ariadne to get out again. This mystery, as in the story of the wanderings of Odysseus, means there can be no victory or no solution until the offended gods have been placated. Therefore, whatever you have done to hurt the gods' feelings or to injure them in some way, you must make it right to escape the final punishment of those deities. And much of your Greek drama is based upon man struggling against the fates of the gods whom he has offended, and also finding ways to seek their forgiveness or to cause them to cease their injury of him. This, of course, is not a personal thing. It is the Greek thinking mind recognizing that the outraged deity is a law offended, that law that has been offended must be placated. The individual must rise to certain problems. And here in your Orphic Mysteries, you find the beginnings of your doctrine of atonement. You have the doctrine of the individual who cannot undo what he has done, actually. But he must therefore go through a penance. He must be tested. He must be enslaved. He must become the servant of an outraged deity and fulfill any task that deity requires until finally he is forgiven for his mistake. These deities are all laws, and every law offended becomes a master to which the lawbreaker is attached as a slave until the law is compensated. The moment the law is compensated and all is right, the slave is liberated. But we are all slaves to the laws we have broken. We are all, to a measure, under the penances of the gods we have offended. But these gods are not persons who don't like us. These gods are the great triune principle of principles operating on various levels of existence, which through ignorance or perversion we have offended. And by necessity we must correct our mistake. And by themis, which is learning out of this necessity, man ultimately chooses the right, achieves the good, and returns to the divine world from which he came. The romance of the gods descending and of man ascending, these are the burdens of the great Greek drama and the dance and the music and the literature of this people. And I think as we go on with it, we will perceive that it possesses a real and deep interest for us. There are many phases of it which cannot be reconstructed out of the ancient times. But we do know that these people rationalized on these principles, that they gave us the principles of psychology, and that in this psychology, under the heading of Zeus, they personified the whole terrible, troublous monument of the mind. This mind which has plagued us, and around which so many psychological systems have later been developed. The problem of mind as the universal tyrant and the private despot, and the victory of man over time, the victory of man over his own emotions and of mind. These are the proper discourses of the mysteries. Because as Apuleius tells us, in the metamorphosis. It is the power or right of the mystai that as he approaches the sanctuary, that he shall behold God face to face in his own true and natural likeness, which means nothing more nor less than that principles shall be seen in their substance rather than in their appearances, that the mask shall be removed, because in the Greek drama it was usual for the gods to always be masked. Other characters were also masked, but in the mythologies and in the rituals, the masked gods represented principles concealed behind the appearances that we have created for them. Therefore, we think we see the god, but we see only our own interpretation of the principle. But by the mysteries, we behold the gods face to face. We therefore behold the principles, the laws, the rules, the living energies, the eternal substances in their proper and natural appearance and form, and in so doing can no longer be deceived by the falseness of appearances. For that which we have seen through a glass darkly, we shall then see face to face. And all these principles which form the great Greek theology are principles seen by us through a glass darkly, but through the great institution of the mysteries, we shall be permitted to tread upon the threshold of Prosperity. We shall be allowed to enter into the sanctuary and come into the Aditum, where the gods behold us and we behold them face to face. The Greeks were not sure which would be the most surprised, man or the gods. Because only when man discovers the gods can the gods see man or themselves. It is a very intricate and interesting system, and certainly much more important than mere mythology. Well, I think that's enough.